Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The New York Trilogy by Paul Auster, performed by Joe Barrett, produced by Audible Incorporated.
Chapter 1. It was a wrong number that started it, the telephone ringing 3 times in the dead of night and the voice on the other end asking for someone he was not. Much later, when he was able to think about the things that happened to him, he would conclude that nothing was real except chance. But that was much later. In the beginning, there was simply the event and its consequences. Whether it might have turned out differently or whether it was all predetermined with the first word that came from the stranger's mouth is not the question. The question is the story itself, and whether or not it means something is not for the story to tell. As for Quinn, there is little that need detain us. Who he was, where he came from, and what he did are of no great importance. We know, for example, that he was 35 years old. We know that he had once been married, had once been a father, and that both his wife and son were now dead. We also know that he wrote books. To be precise, we know that he wrote mystery novels. These works were written under the name of William Wilson, and he produced them at the rate of about 1 a year, which brought in enough money for him to live modestly in a small New York apartment. Because he spent no more than 5 or 6 months on a novel, for the rest of the year he was free to do as he wished. He read many books, he looked at paintings, he went to the movies. In the summer he watched baseball on television. In the winter he went to the opera. More than anything else, however, what he liked to do was walk. Nearly every day, rain or shine, hot or cold, he would leave his apartment to walk through the city, never really going anywhere, but simply going wherever his legs happened to take him. New York was an inexhaustible space, a labyrinth of endless steps, and no matter how far he walked, no matter how well he came to know its neighborhoods and streets, it always left him with the feeling of being lost. Lost, not only in the city, but within himself as well. Each time he took a walk, he felt as though he were leaving himself behind, and by giving himself up to the movement of the streets, by reducing himself to a seeing eye, he was able to escape the obligation to think. And this, more than anything else, brought him a measure of peace, a salutary emptiness within. The world was outside of him, around him, before him, and the speed with which it kept changing made it impossible for him to dwell on any one thing for very long. Motion was of the essence, the act of putting one foot in front of the other and allowing himself to follow the drift of his own body. By wandering aimlessly, all places became equal, and it no longer mattered where he was. On his best walks, he was able to feel that he was nowhere. And this, finally, was all he ever asked of things. To be nowhere. New York was the nowhere he had built around himself, and he realized that he had no intention of ever leaving it again. In the past, Quinn had been more ambitious. As a young man, he had published several books of poetry, had written plays, critical essays, and had worked on a number of long translations. But quite abruptly, he had given up all that. A part of him had died, he told his friends, and he did not want it coming back to haunt him. It was then that he had taken on the name of William Wilson. Quinn was no longer that part of him that could write books, and although in many ways Quinn continued to exist, he no longer existed for anyone but himself. He had continued to write because it was the only thing he felt he could do. Mystery novels seemed a reasonable solution. He had little trouble inventing the intricate stories they required, and he wrote well, often in spite of himself, as if without having to make an effort. Because he did not consider himself to be the author of what he wrote, he did not feel responsible for it, and therefore was not compelled to defend it in his heart. William Wilson, after all, was an invention, and even though he had been born within Quinn himself, he now led an independent life. Quinn treated him with deference, at times even admiration, but he never went so far as to believe that he and William Wilson were the same man. It was for this reason that he did not emerge from behind the mask of his pseudonym. He had an agent, but they had never met. Their contacts were confined to the mail, for which purpose Quinn had rented a numbered box at the post office. The same was true of the publisher, who paid all fees, monies, and royalties to Quinn through the agent. No book by William Wilson ever included an author's photograph or biographical note. William Wilson was not listed in any writer's directory. He did not give interviews, and all the letters he received were answered by his agent's secretary. As far as Quinn could tell, no one knew his secret. In the beginning, when his friends learned that he had given up writing, they would ask him how he was planning to live. He told them all the same thing, that he had inherited a trust fund from his wife. But the fact was that his wife had never had any money, and the fact was that he no longer had any friends. It had been more than 5 years now. He did not think about his son very much anymore, and only recently he had removed the photograph of his wife from the wall. Every once in a while, he would suddenly feel what it had been like to hold the 3-year-old boy in his arms. But that was not exactly thinking, nor was it even remembering. It was a physical sensation, an imprint of the past that had been left in his body, and he had no control over it. These moments came less often now, and for the most part it seemed as though things had begun to change for him. He no longer wished to be dead. At the same time, it cannot be said that he was glad to be alive, but at least he did not resent it. He was alive, and the stubbornness of this fact had little by little begun to fascinate him, as if he had managed to outlive himself, as if he were somehow living a posthumous life. He did not sleep with the lamp on anymore, and for many months now he had not remembered any of his dreams. It was night. Quinn lay in bed smoking a cigarette, listening to the rain beat against the window. He wondered when it would stop and whether he would feel like taking a long walk or a short walk in the morning. An open copy of Marco Polo's Travels lay face down on the pillow beside him. Since finishing the latest William Wilson novel 2 weeks earlier, he had been languishing. His private eye narrator, Max Work, had solved an elaborate series of crimes, had suffered through a number of beatings and narrow escapes, and Quinn was feeling somewhat exhausted by his efforts. Over the years, Work had become very close to Quinn. Whereas William Wilson remained an abstract figure for him, Work had increasingly come to life. In the triad of selves that Quinn had become, Wilson served as a kind of ventriloquist. Quinn himself was the dummy, and Work was the animated voice that gave purpose to the enterprise. If Wilson was an illusion, he nevertheless justified the lives of the other two. If Wilson did not exist, he nevertheless was the bridge that allowed Quinn to pass from himself into Work. And little by little, Work had become a presence in Quinn's life, his interior brother, his comrade in solitude. Quinn picked up the Marco Polo and started reading the first page again. "We will set down things seen as seen, things heard as heard, so that our book may be an accurate record, free from any sort of fabrication, and all who read this book or hear it may do so with full confidence, because it contains nothing but the truth." Just as Quinn was beginning to ponder the meaning of these sentences, to turn their crisp assurances over in his mind, the telephone rang. Much later, when he was able to reconstruct the events of that night, he would remember looking at the clock, seeing that it was past 12, and wondering why someone should be calling him at that hour. More than likely, he thought it was bad news. He climbed out of bed, walked naked to the telephone, and picked up the receiver on the second ring. "Yes?" There was a long pause on the other end, and for a moment Quinn thought the caller had hung up. Then, as if from a great distance, there came the sound of a voice unlike any he had ever heard. It was at once mechanical and filled with feeling. hardly more than a whisper and yet perfectly audible, and so even in tone that he was unable to tell if it belonged to a man or a woman. "Hello?" said the voice. "Who is this?" asked Quinn. "Hello," said the voice again. "I'm listening," said Quinn. "Who is this?"
"Is this Paul Auster?" asked the voice.
"I would like to speak to Mr. Paul Auster."
"There's no one here by that name."
"Paul Auster, of the Auster Detective Agency."
"I'm sorry," said Quinn. "You must have the wrong number."
"This is a matter of utmost urgency," said the voice.
"There's nothing I can do for you," said Quinn. "There is no Paul Auster here."
"You don't understand," said the voice. "Time is running out."
"Then I suggest you dial again. This is not a detective agency." Quinn hung up the phone. He stood there on the cold floor, looking down at his feet, his knees, his limp penis. For a brief moment, he regretted having been so abrupt with the caller. It might have been interesting, he thought, to have played along with him a little. Perhaps he could have found out something about the case, perhaps even have helped in some way. "I must learn to think more quickly on my feet," he said to himself. Like most people, Quinn knew almost nothing about crime. He had never murdered anyone, had never stolen anything, and he did not know anyone who had. He had never been inside a police station, had never met a private detective, had never spoken to a criminal. Whatever he knew about these things, he had learned from books, films, and newspapers. He did not, however, consider this to be a handicap. What interested him about the stories he wrote was not their relation to the world, but their relation to other stories. Even before he became William Wilson, Quinn had been a devoted reader of mystery novels. He knew that most of them were poorly written, that most could not stand up to even the vaguest sort of examination, but still, it was the form that appealed to him, and it was the rare, unspeakably bad mystery that he would refuse to read. Whereas his taste in other books was rigorous, demanding to the point of narrow-mindedness, with these works, he showed almost no discrimination whatsoever. When he was in the right mood, he had little trouble reading 10 or 12 of them in a row. It was a kind of hunger that took hold of him, a craving for a special food, and he would not stop until he had eaten his fill. What he liked about these books was their sense of plenitude and economy. In the good mystery, there is nothing wasted, no sentence, no word that is not significant. And even if it is not significant, it has the potential to be so, which amounts to the same thing. The world of the book comes to life, seething with possibilities, with secrets and contradictions. Since everything seen or said, even the slightest, most trivial thing, can bear a connection to the outcome of the story, nothing must be overlooked. Everything becomes essence. The center of the book shifts with each event that propels it forward. The center, then, is everywhere, and no circumference can be drawn until the book has come to its end. The detective is one who looks, who listens, who moves through this morass of objects and events in search of the thought, the idea, that will pull all these things together and make sense of them. In effect, the writer and the detective are interchangeable. The reader sees the world through the detective's eyes, experiencing the proliferation of its details as if for the first time. He has become awake to the things around him, as if they might speak to him, as if, because of the attentiveness he now brings to them, they might begin to carry a meaning other than the simple fact of their existence. Private eye. The term held a triple meaning for Quinn. Not only was it the letter I, standing for investigator, it was I in the uppercase, the tiny life bud buried in the body of the breathing self. At the same time, it was also the physical eye of the writer, the eye of the man who looks out from himself into the world and demands that the world reveal itself to him. For 5 years now, Quinn had been living in the grip of this pun. He had, of course, long ago stopped thinking of himself as real. If he lived now in the world at all, it was only at one remove, through the imaginary person of Mac's work. His detective necessarily had to be real. The nature of the books demanded it. If Quinn had allowed himself to vanish, to withdraw into the confines of a strange and hermetic life, work continued to live in the world of others, and the more Quinn seemed to vanish, the more persistent work's presence in that world became. Whereas Quinn tended to feel out of place in his own skin, work was aggressive, quick-tongued, at home in whatever spot he happened to find himself. The very things that caused problems for Quinn, work took for granted, and he walked through the mayhem of his adventures with an ease and indifference that never failed to impress his creator. It was not precisely that Quinn wanted to be work or even to be like him, but it reassured him to pretend to be work as he was writing his books, to know that he had it in him to be work if he ever chose to be, even if only in his mind. That night, as he at last drifted off to sleep, Quinn tried to imagine what work would have said to the stranger on the phone. In his dream, which he later forgot, he found himself alone in a room, firing a pistol into a bare white wall. The following night, Quinn was caught off guard. He had thought the incident was over and was not expecting the stranger to call again. As it happened, he was sitting on the toilet, in the act of expelling a turd, when the telephone rang. It was somewhat later than the previous night, perhaps 10 or 12 minutes before 1. Quinn had just reached the chapter that tells of Marco Polo's journey from Peking to Amoy, and the book was open on his lap as he went about his business in the tiny bathroom. The ringing of the telephone came as a distinct irritation. To answer it promptly would mean getting up without wiping himself, and he was loath to walk across the apartment in that state. On the other hand, if he finished what he was doing at his normal speed, he would not make it to the phone in time. In spite of this, Quinn found himself reluctant to move. The telephone was not his favorite object, and more than once he had considered getting rid of his. What he disliked most of all was its tyranny. Not only did it have the power to interrupt him against his will, but inevitably he would give in to its command. This time he decided to resist. By the third ring, his bowels were empty. By the fourth ring, he had succeeded in wiping himself. By the fifth ring, he had pulled up his pants, left the bathroom, and was walking calmly across the apartment. He answered the phone on the sixth ring, but there was no one at the other end. The caller had hung up. The next night, he was ready. Sprawled out on his bed, perusing the pages of the Sporting News, he waited for the stranger to call a third time. Every now and then, when his nerves got the better of him, he would stand up and pace about the apartment. He put on a record, Haydn's opera Il Mondo della Luna, and listened to it from start to finish. He waited and waited. At 2:30, he finally gave up and went to sleep. He waited the next night, and the night after that as well. Just as he was about to abandon his scheme, realizing that he had been wrong in all his assumptions, the telephone rang again. It was May 19th. He would remember the date because it was his parents' anniversary, or would have been had his parents been alive, and his mother had once told him that he had been conceived on her wedding night. This fact had always appealed to him, being able to pinpoint the first moment of his existence, and over the years he had privately celebrated his birthday on that day. This time it was somewhat earlier than on the other two nights, not yet 11 o'clock, and as he reached for the phone he assumed it was someone else. "Hello," he said. Again there was a silence on the other end. Quinn knew at once that it was the stranger. "Hello," he said again. "What can I do for you?"
"Yes," said the voice at last.
the same mechanical whisper, the same desperate tone.
Yes, it is needed now, without delay.
What is needed?
To speak right now. To speak right now. Yes.
And who do you want to speak to?
Always the same man, Oster, the one who calls himself Paul Oster.
This time Quinn did not hesitate. He knew what he was going to do, and now that the time had come, he did it. Speaking, he said. This is Oster speaking.
At last I found you.
He could hear the relief in the voice, the tangible calm that suddenly seemed to overtake it. That's right, said Quinn. At last. He paused for a moment to let the words sink in, as much for himself as for the other. What can I do for you?
I need help, said the voice. There is great danger. They say you are the best one to do these things.
It depends on what things you mean.
I mean death. I mean death and murder.
That's not exactly my line, said Quinn. I don't go around killing people.
No, said the voice petulantly. I mean the reverse.
Someone is going to kill you?
Yes, kill me. That's right. I am going to be murdered.
And you want me to protect you?
To protect me, yes, and to find the man who is going to do it.
You don't know who it is?
I know, yes. Of course I know, but I don't know where he is.
Can you tell me about it?
Not now. Not on the phone. There is great danger. You must come here.
How about tomorrow?
Good. Tomorrow. Early tomorrow. In the morning.
10 o'clock?
Good. 10 o'clock.
The voice gave an address on East 69th Street.
Don't forget, Mr. Oster. You must come.
Don't worry, said Quinn. I'll be there. Chapter 2. The next morning, Quinn woke up earlier than he had in several weeks. As he drank his coffee, buttered his toast, and read through the baseball scores in the paper, the Mets had lost again 2-1 on a ninth inning error, it did not occur to him that he was going to show up for his appointment. Even that locution, his appointment, seemed odd to him. It wasn't his appointment, it was Paul Oster's. And who that person was, he had no idea. Nevertheless, as time wore on, he found himself doing a good imitation of a man preparing to go out. He cleared the table of the breakfast dishes, tossed the newspaper on the couch, went into the bathroom, showered, shaved, went on to the bedroom wrapped in two towels, opened the closet, and picked out his clothes for the day. He found himself tending toward a jacket and tie. Quinn had not worn a tie since the funerals of his wife and son, and he could not even remember if he still owned one. But there it was, hanging amidst the debris of his wardrobe. He dismissed a white shirt as too formal, however, and instead chose a gray and red check affair to go with the gray tie. He put them on in a kind of trance. It was not until he had his hand on the doorknob that he began to suspect what he was doing. I seem to be going out, he said to himself. But if I am going out, where exactly am I going? An hour later, as he climbed from the number 4 bus at 70th Street and 5th Avenue, he still had not answered the question. To one side of him was the park, green in the morning sun, with sharp, fleeting shadows. To the other side was the Frick, white and austere, as if abandoned to the dead. He thought for a moment of Vermeer's Soldier and Young Girl Smiling, trying to remember the expression on the girl's face, the exact position of her hands around the cup, the red back of the faceless man. In his mind, he caught a glimpse of the blue map on the wall and the sunlight pouring through the window, so like the sunlight that surrounded him now. He was walking. He was crossing the street and moving eastward. At Madison Avenue, he turned right and went south for a block, then turned left and saw where he was. I seem to have arrived, he said to himself. He stood before the building and paused. It suddenly did not seem to matter anymore. He felt remarkably calm, as if everything had already happened to him. As he opened the door that would lead him into the lobby, he gave himself one last word of advice. If all this is really happening, he said, then I must keep my eyes open. It was a woman who opened the apartment door. For some reason, Quinn had not been expecting this, and it threw him off track. Already, things were happening too fast. Before he had a chance to absorb the woman's presence, to describe her to himself and form his impressions, she was talking to him, forcing him to respond. Therefore, even in those first moments, he had lost ground, was starting to fall behind himself. Later, when he had time to reflect on these events, he would manage to piece together his encounter with the woman. But that was the work of memory, and remembered things, he knew, had a tendency to subvert the things remembered. As a consequence, he could never be sure of any of it. The woman was 30, perhaps 35, average height at best, hips a touch wide or else voluptuous, depending on your point of view, dark hair, dark eyes, and a look in those eyes that was at once self-contained and vaguely seductive. She wore a black dress and very red lipstick. Mr. Oster? A tentative smile, a questioning tilt to the head. That's right, said Quinn. Paul Oster. I'm Virginia Stillman, the woman began. Peter's wife. He's been waiting for you since 8 o'clock. The appointment was for 10, said Quinn, glancing at his watch. It was exactly 10. He's been frantic, the woman explained. I've never seen him like this before. He just couldn't wait. She opened the door for Quinn. As he crossed the threshold and entered the apartment, he could feel himself going blank, as if his brain had suddenly shut off. He had wanted to take in the details of what he was seeing, but the task was somehow beyond him at that moment. The apartment loomed up around him as a kind of blur. He realized that it was large, perhaps 5 or 6 rooms, and that it was richly furnished with numerous art objects, silver ashtrays, and elaborately framed paintings on the walls. But that was all, no more than a general impression, even though he was there, looking at those things with his own eyes. He found himself sitting on a sofa, alone in the living room. He remembered now that Mrs. Stillman had told him to wait there while she went to find her husband. He couldn't say how long it had been, surely no more than a minute or two. But from the way the light was coming through the windows, it seemed to be almost noon. It did not occur to him, however, to consult his watch. The smell of Virginia Stillman's perfume hovered around him, and he began to imagine what she looked like without any clothes on. Then he thought about what Max Work might have been thinking, had he been there. He decided to light a cigarette. He blew the smoke into the room. It pleased him to watch it leave his mouth in gusts, disperse, and take on new definition as the light caught it. He heard the sound of someone entering the room behind him. Quinn stood up from the sofa and turned around, expecting to see Mrs. Stillman. Instead, it was a young man, dressed entirely in white, with the white blonde hair of a child. Uncannily, in that first moment, Quinn thought of his own dead son. Then, just as suddenly as the thought had appeared, it vanished. Peter Stillman walked into the room and sat down in a red velvet armchair opposite Quinn. He said not a word as he made his way to his seat, nor did he acknowledge Quinn's presence. The act of moving from one place to another seemed to require all his attention, as though not to think of what he was doing would reduce him to immobility. Quinn had never seen anyone move in such a manner, and he realized at once that this was the same person he had spoken to on the phone. The body acted almost exactly as the voice had, machine-like, fitful, alternating between slow and rapid gestures, rigid and yet expressive, as if the operation were out of control, not quite corresponding to the will that lay behind it. It seemed to Quinn that Stillman's body had not been used for a long time, and that all its functions had been relearned, so that motion had become a conscious process, each movement broken down into its component sub-movements, with the result that all flow and spontaneity had been lost. It was like watching a marionette trying to walk without strings. Everything about Peter Stillman was white. White shirt, open at the neck, white pants, white shoes, white socks. Against the pallor of his skin, the flaxen thinness of his hair, the effect was almost transparent, as though one could see through to the blue veins behind the skin of his face. This blue was almost the same as the blue of his eyes, a milky blue that seemed to dissolve into a mixture of sky and clouds. Quinn could not imagine himself addressing a word to this person. It was as though Stillman's presence was a command to be silent. Stillman settled slowly into his chair and at last turned his attention to Quinn. As their eyes met, Quinn suddenly felt that Stillman had become invisible. He could see him, sitting in the chair across from him, but at the same time it felt as though he was not there. It occurred to Quinn that perhaps Stillman was blind. But no, that did not seem possible. The man was looking at him, even studying him, and if recognition did not flicker across his face, it still held something more than a blank stare. Quinn did not know what to do. He sat there dumbly in his seat, looking back at Stillman.
A long time passed.
"No questions, please,"
the young man said at last.
"Yes, no, thank you."
He paused for a moment.
"I am Peter Stillman. I say this of my own free will. Yes, that is not my real name. No, of course, my mind is not all it should be. But nothing can be done about that. No, about that. No, no, not anymore. You sit there and think, who is this person talking to me? What are these words coming from his mouth? I will tell you. Or else I will not tell you. Yes and no. My mind is not all it should be. I say this of my own free will, but I will try. Yes and no. I will try to tell you, even if my mind makes it hard. Thank you. My name is Peter Stillman. Perhaps you have heard of me, but more than likely not. No matter. That is not my real name. My real name I cannot remember. Excuse me, not that it makes a difference. That is to say, any more. This is what is called speaking. I believe that is the term. When words come out, fly into the air, live for a moment, and die. Strange, is it not? I myself have no opinion, no and no again. But still there are words you will need to have. There are many of them, many millions, I think. Perhaps only 3 or 4. Excuse me, but I am doing well today. So much better than usual. If I can give you the words you need to have, it will be a great victory. Thank you. Thank you 1,000,000 times over. Long ago, there was mother and father. I remember none of that. They say mother died. Who they are, I cannot say. Excuse me, but that is what they say. No mother then. Ha ha! Such is my laughter now, my belly burst of mumbo-jumbo. Ha ha ha! Big father say, it makes no difference to me. That is to say, to him, big father of the big muscles and the boom, boom, boom. No questions now, please. I say what they say because I know nothing. I am only poor Peter Stillman, the boy who can't remember. Boo-hoo, willy-nilly, nincompoop, Excuse me. They say. But what does poor little Peter say? Nothing anymore. There was this dark, very dark, as dark as very dark. They say that was the room. As if I could talk about it. The dark, I mean, thank you. Dark. Dark. They say for 9 years. Not even a window. Poor Peter Stillman. And the boom, boom, boom. The caca piles. The pee-pee legs. The swoons. Excuse me. Numb and naked. Excuse me. Anymore. There is the dark, then. I am telling you. There was food in the dark, yes, mush food in the hush dark room. He ate with his hands. Excuse me, I mean Peter did. And if I am Peter, so much the better. That is to say, so much the worse. Excuse me. I am Peter Stillman. That is not my real name. Thank you. Poor Peter Stillman, a little boy he was, barely a few words of his own, and then no words, and then no one, and then no, any more. Forgive me, Mr. Oster, I see that I am making you sad. No questions, please. My name is Peter Stillman, that is not my real name, my real name is Mr. Sad. What is your name, Mr. Oster? Perhaps you are the real Mr. Sad, and I am no one. Boo-hoo. Excuse me, such is my weeping and wailing. Boo-hoo, sob, sob. What did Peter do in that room? No one can say. Some say nothing. As for me, I think that Peter could not think. Did he blink? Did he drink? Did he stink? Ha ha ha! Excuse me, sometimes I am so funny. Wimble, click, crumble, chub, baloo. Clack, clack, bedrack. Num noise, flackle much, chumana, ya ya ya. Excuse me, I am the only one who understands these words. Later and later and later. So they say. It went on too long for Peter to be right in the head. Never again. No. They say that someone found me. I do not remember. No, I do not remember what happened when they opened the door and the light came in. No. I can say nothing about any of this anymore. For a long time, I wore dark glasses. I was 12, or so they say. I lived in a hospital. Little by little, they taught me how to be Peter Stillman. They said, "You are Peter Stillman." "Thank you," I said. Ya. "Thank you and thank you," I said. Peter was a baby. They had to teach him everything. How to walk, you know. How to eat. How to make caca and pee-pee in the toilet. That wasn't bad. Even when I bit them, they didn't do the boom, boom, boom. Later, I even stopped tearing off my clothes. Peter was a good boy, but it was hard to teach him words. His mouth did not work right. And of course, he was not all there in his head. Ba, 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 he said. And da-da-da, and wah-wah-wah. Excuse me, it took more years and years. Now they say to Peter, "You can go now, there's nothing more we can do for you." "Peter Stillman, you are a human being," they said. "It is good to believe what doctors say. Thank you so very much. I am Peter Stillman, that is not my real name. My real name is Peter Rabbit." "In the winter, I am Mr. White. In the summer, I am Mr. Green." Think what you like of this. I say it of my own free will. Wimble, click, crumple, cha-beloo. It is beautiful, is it not? I make up words like this all the time. That can't be helped. They just come out of my mouth by themselves. They cannot be translated. Ask and ask, it does no good. But I will tell you, I don't want you to be sad, Mr. Oster. You have such a kind face. You remind me of a some such or a groan. I don't know which. And your eyes look at me. Yes, yes, I can see them. That is very good. Thank you. That is why I will tell you. No questions, please. You are wondering about all the rest, that is to say the father, the terrible father who did all those things to little Peter. Rest assured, they took him to a dark place. They locked him up and left him there. Ha ha ha! Excuse me, sometimes I am so funny. 13 years, they said. That is perhaps a long time, but I know nothing of time. I am new every day. I am born when I wake up in the morning. I grow old during the day, and I die at night when I go to sleep. It is not my fault. I am doing so well today. I am doing so much better than I have ever done before. For 13 years, the father was away. His name is Peter Stillman, too. Strange, is it not, that two people can have the same name? I do not know if that is his real name, but I do not think he is me. We are both Peter Stillman, but Peter Stillman is not my real name, so perhaps I am not Peter Stillman, after all. 13 years, I say. Or they say, it makes no difference, I know nothing of time. But what they tell me is this: tomorrow is the end of 13 years. That is bad. Even though they say it is not, it is bad. I am not supposed to remember, but now and then I do, in spite of what I say. He will come. That is to say, the father will come. And he will try to kill me. Thank you. But I do not want that. No, no, not anymore. Peter lives now. Yes, all is not right in his head, but still he lives. And that is something, is it not? You bet your bottom dollar. Ha ha ha! I am mostly now a poet. Every day I sit in my room and write another poem. I make up all the words myself, just like when I lived in the dark. I begin to remember things that way, to pretend that I am back in the dark again. I am the only one who knows what the words mean. They cannot be translated. These poems will make me famous. Hit the nail on the head. Ya, ya, ya. Beautiful poems. So beautiful, the whole world will weep. Later, perhaps I will do something else, after I am done being a poet. Sooner or later, I will run out of words, you see. Everyone has just so many words inside him, and then where will I be? I think I would like to be a fireman after that, and after that, a doctor. It makes no difference. The last thing I will be is a high-wire walker. When I am very old and have at last learned how to walk like other people, then I will dance on the wire and people will be amazed. Even little children, that is what I would like, to dance on the wire until I die. But no matter, it makes no difference to me. As you can see, I am a rich man. I do not have to worry, no, no, not about that. You bet your bottom dollar. The father was rich, and little Peter got all his money after they locked him up in the dark. Ha ha ha! Excuse me for laughing. Sometimes I am so funny. I am the last of the Stillmans. That was quite a family, or so they say. from old Boston, in case you might have heard of it. I am the last one. There are no others. I am the end of everyone, the last man. So much the better, I think. It is not a pity that it should all end now. It is good for everyone to be dead. The father was perhaps not really bad. At least I say so now. He had a big head, as big as very big, which meant there was too much room in there. So many thoughts in that big head of his. But poor Peter, was he not? And in terrible straits indeed. Peter, who could not see or say, who could not think or do. Peter, who could not. No, not anything. I know nothing of any of this, nor do I understand. My wife is the one who tells me these things. She says it is important for me to know, even if I do not understand. But even this I do not understand. In order to know, you must understand. Is that not so? But I know nothing. Perhaps I am Peter Stillman, and perhaps I am not. My real name is Peter Nobody. Thank you. And what do you think of that? So I am telling you about the father. It is a good story, even if I do not understand it. I can tell it to you because I know the words, and that is something, is it not? To know the words, I mean. Sometimes I am so proud of myself. Excuse me. This is what my wife says. She says the father talked about God. That is a funny word to me. When you put it backwards, it spells dog. And a dog is not much like God, is it? Woof, woof. Bow, wow. Those are dog words. I think they are beautiful, so pretty and true, like the words I make up. Anyway, I was saying, the father talked about God. He wanted to know if God had a language. Don't ask me what this means. I am only telling you because I know the words. The father thought a baby might speak it if the baby saw no people. But what baby was there? Ah, now you begin to see. You did not have to buy him. Of course, Peter knew some people words. That could not be helped. But the father thought maybe Peter would forget them. After a while, that is why there was so much boom, boom, boom. Every time Peter said a word, his father would boom him. At last, Peter learned to say nothing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thank you. Peter kept the words inside him. All those days and months and years, there in the dark, little Peter all alone, and the words made noise in his head and kept him company. That is why his mouth does not work right. Poor Peter. Boo-hoo. Such are his tears. The little boy who can never grow up. Peter can talk like people now, but he still has the other words in his head. They are God's language, and no one else can speak them. They cannot be translated. That is why Peter lives so close to God. That is why he is a famous poet. Everything is so good for me now. I can do whatever I like, any time, any place. I even have a wife. You can see that. I mentioned her before. Perhaps you have even met her. She is beautiful, is she not? Her name is Virginia. That is not her real name, but that makes no difference to me. Whenever I ask, my wife gets a girl for me. They are whores. I put my worm inside them and they moan. There have been so many. Ha ha. They come up here and I fuck them. It feels good to fuck. Virginia gives them money and everyone is happy. You bet your bottom dollar. Ha ha. poor Virginia. She does not like to fuck. That is to say, with me. Perhaps she fucks another. Who can say? I know nothing of this. It makes no difference. But maybe if you are nice to Virginia, she will let you fuck her. It would make me happy. For your sake, thank you. So, there are a great many things. I am trying to tell them to you. I know that all is not right in my head, and it is true, yes, and I say this of my own free will, that sometimes I just scream and scream for no good reason, as if there had to be a reason, but for none that I can see, or anyone else, no. And then there are the times when I say nothing, for days and days on end, nothing, nothing, nothing. I forget how to make the words come out of my mouth. Then it is hard for me to move, yeah, or even to see. That is when I become Mr. Sad. I still like to be in the dark, at least sometimes. It does me good, I think. In the dark, I speak God's language and no one can hear me. Do not be angry, please. I cannot help it. Best of all, there is the air. Yes, and little by little I have learned to live inside it. The air and the light, yes, that too, the light that shines on all things and puts them there for my eyes to see. There is the air and the light, and this, best of all, excuse me, the air and the light, yes. When the weather is good, I like to sit by the open window. Sometimes I look out and watch the things below, the street and all the people, the dogs and cars, the bricks of the building across the way. And then there are the times when I close my eyes and just sit there, with the breeze blowing on my face and the light inside the air all around me and just beyond my eyes, and the world all red, a beautiful red inside my eyes, with the sun shining on me and my eyes. It is true that I rarely go out. It is hard for me, and I am not always to be trusted. Sometimes I scream. Do not be angry with me, please. I cannot help it. Virginia says I must learn how to behave in public. But sometimes I cannot help myself, and the screams just come out of me. But I do love going to the park. There are the trees and the air and the light. There is good in all that, is there not? Yes. Little by little I am getting better. Inside myself I can feel it. Even Dr. Vishnogradsky says so. I know that I am still the puppet boy. That cannot be helped, no, anymore. But sometimes I think I will at last grow up and become real. For now, I am still Peter Stillman. That is not my real name. I cannot say who I will be tomorrow. Each day is new, and each day I am born again. I see hope everywhere, even in the dark, and when I die I will perhaps become God. There are many more words to speak, but I do not think I will speak them. No, not today. My mouth is tired now, and I think the time has come for me to go. Of course, I know nothing of time. But that makes no difference to me. Thank you very much. I know you will save my life, Mr. Oster. I am counting on you. Life can last just so long, you understand. Everything else is in the room, with darkness, with God's language, with screams. Here, I am of the air. A beautiful thing for the light to shine on. Perhaps you will remember that. I am Peter Stillman. That is not my real name. Thank you very much.
Chapter 3. The speech was over. How long it had lasted, Quinn could not say, for it was only now, after the words had stopped, that he realized they were sitting in the dark. Apparently a whole day had gone by. At some point during Stillman's monologue, the sun had set in the room, but Quinn had not been aware of it. Now he could feel the darkness and the silence, and his head was humming with them. Several minutes went by. Quinn thought that perhaps it was up to him to say something now, but he could not be sure. He could hear Peter Stillman breathing heavily in his spot across the room. Other than that, there were no sounds. Quinn could not decide what to do. He thought of several possibilities, but then one by one dismissed them from his mind. He sat there in his seat, waiting for the next thing to happen. The sound of stockinged legs moving across the room finally broke the silence. There was the metal click of a lamp switch, and suddenly the room was filled with light. Quinn's eyes automatically turned to its source, and there, standing beside a table lamp to the left of Peter's chair, he saw Virginia Stillman. The young man was gazing straight ahead as if asleep with his eyes open. Mrs. Stillman bent over, put her arm around Peter's shoulder, and spoke softly into his ear.
"It's time now, Peter," she said. "Mrs. Saavedra is waiting for you."
Peter looked up at her and smiled.
"I am filled with hope," he said.
Virginia Stillman kissed her husband tenderly on the cheek.
"Say goodbye to Mr. Oster," she said.
Peter stood up. Or rather, he began the sad, slow adventure of maneuvering his body out of the chair and working his way to his feet. At each stage, there were relapses, crumplings, catapults back, accompanied by sudden fits of immobility, grunts, words whose meaning Quinn could not decipher. At last, Peter was upright. He stood in front of his chair with an expression of triumph and looked Quinn in the eyes. Then he smiled, broadly and without self-consciousness.
"Goodbye," he said.
"Goodbye, Peter," said Quinn.
Peter gave a little spastic wave of the hand and then slowly turned and walked across the room. He tottered as he went, listing first to the right, then to the left, his legs by turns buckling and locking. At the far end of the room, standing in a lighted doorway, was a middle-aged woman dressed in a white nurse's uniform. Quinn assumed it was Mrs. Saavedra. He followed Peter Stillman with his eyes until the young man disappeared through the door. Virginia Stillman sat down across from Quinn in the same chair her husband had just occupied.
"I could have spared you all that," she said, "but I thought it would be best for you to see it with your own eyes."
"I understand," said Quinn.
"No, I don't think you do,"
the woman said bitterly.
"I don't think anyone can understand."
Quinn smiled judiciously and then told himself to plunge in.
"Whatever I do or do not understand," he said, "is probably beside the point. You've hired me to do a job, and the sooner I get on with it, the better. From what I can gather, the case is urgent. I make no claims about understanding Peter or what you might have suffered. The important thing is that I'm willing to help. I think you should take it for what it's worth."
He was warming up now. Something told him that he had captured the right tone, and a sudden sense of pleasure surged through him, as though he had just managed to cross some internal border within himself.
"You're right," said Virginia Stillman. "Of course, you're right."
The woman paused, took a deep breath, and then paused again, as if rehearsing in her mind the things she was about to say. Quinn noticed that her hands were clenched tightly around the arms of the chair.
"I realize," she went on, "that most of what Peter says is very confusing, especially the first time you hear him. I was standing in the next room listening to what he said to you. You mustn't assume that Peter always tells the truth. On the other hand, it would be wrong to think he lies.
You mean that I should believe some of the things he said and not believe others?
That's exactly what I mean.
Your sexual habits, or lack of them, don't concern me, Mrs. Stillman, said Quinn. Even if what Peter said is true, it makes no difference. In my line of work, you tend to meet a little of everything. And if you don't learn to suspend judgment, you'll never get anywhere. I'm used to hearing people's secrets, and I'm also used to keeping my mouth shut. If a fact has no direct bearing on a case, I have no use for it.
Mrs. Stillman blushed. I just wanted you to know that what Peter said isn't true.
Quinn shrugged, took out a cigarette, and lit it. One way or the other, he said. It's not important. What I'm interested in are the other things Peter said. I assume they're true, and if they are, I'd like to hear what you have to say about them.
Yes, they're true.
Virginia Stillman released her grip on the chair and put her right hand under her chin, pensive, as if searching for an attitude of unshakable honesty.
Peter has a child's way of telling it, but what he said is true.
Tell me something about the father, anything you think is relevant.
Peter's father is a Boston Stillman. I'm sure you've heard of the family. There were several governors back in the 19th century, a number of Episcopal bishops, ambassadors, a Harvard president. At the same time, the family made a great deal of money in textiles, shipping, and God knows what else. The details are unimportant, just so long as you have some idea of the background. Peter's father went to Harvard, like everyone else in the family. He studied philosophy and religion and by all accounts was quite brilliant. He wrote his thesis on 16th and 17th century theological interpretations of the New World, and then he took a job in the religion department at Columbia. Not long after that, he married Peter's mother. I don't know much about her. From the photographs I've seen, she was very pretty, but delicate, a little like Peter with those pale blue eyes and white skin. When Peter was born a few years later, the family was living in a large apartment on Riverside Drive. Stillman's academic career was prospering. He rewrote his dissertation and turned it into a book. It did very well, and was made a full professor when he was 34 or 35. Then Peter's mother died. Everything about that death is unclear. Stillman claimed that she had died in her sleep, but the evidence seemed to point to suicide. Something to do with an overdose of pills, but of course nothing could be proved. There was even some talk that he had killed her, but those were just rumors and nothing ever came of it. The whole affair was kept very quiet. Peter was just 2 at the time, a perfectly normal child. After his wife's death, Stillman apparently had little to do with him. A nurse was hired, and for the next 6 months or so, she took complete care of Peter. Then, out of the blue, Stillman fired her. I forget her name, a Miss Barber, I think. But she testified at the trial. It seems that Stillman just came home one day and told her that he was taking charge of Peter's upbringing. He sent in his resignation to Columbia and told them he was leaving the university to devote himself full-time to his son. Money, of course, was no object, and there was nothing anyone could do about it. After that, he more or less dropped out of sight. He stayed on in the same apartment, but he hardly ever went out. No one really knows what happened. I think probably that he began to believe in some of the far-fetched religious ideas he had written about. It made him crazy, absolutely insane. There's no other way to describe it. He locked Peter in a room in the apartment, covered up the windows, and kept him there for 9 years. Try to imagine it, Mr. Oster. 9 years.
an entire childhood spent in darkness, isolated from the world, with no human contact except an occasional beating. I live with the results of that experiment, and I can tell you the damage was monstrous. What you saw today was Peter at his best. It's taken 13 years to get him this far, and I'll be damned if I let anyone hurt him again. Mrs. Stillman stopped to catch her breath. Quinn sensed that she was on the verge of a scene, and that one more word might put her over the edge. He had to speak now, or the conversation would run away from him. "How was Peter finally discovered?" he asked. Some of the tension went out of the woman. She exhaled audibly and looked Quinn in the eyes. "There was a fire," she said.
"An accidental fire or one set on purpose?"
"No one knows."
"What do you think?"
"I think Stillman was in his study. He kept the records of his experiment there, and I think he finally realized that his work had been a failure. I'm not saying that he regretted anything he had done, but even taking it on his own terms, he knew he had failed. I think he reached some point of final disgust with himself that night and decided to burn his papers. But the fire got out of control, and much of the apartment burned. Luckily, Peter's room was at the other end of a long hall, and the firemen got to him in time."
"And then?"
"It took several months to sort everything out. Stillman's papers had been destroyed, which meant there was no concrete evidence. On the other hand, there was Peter's condition, the room he had been locked up in, those horrible boards across the windows, and eventually the police put the case together. Stillman was finally brought to trial."
"What happened in court?"
"Stillman was judged insane, and he was sent away."
"And Peter?"
"He also went to a hospital. He stayed there until just 2 years ago."
"Is that where you met him?"
"Yes, in the hospital."
"How?"
"I was his speech therapist. I worked with Peter every day for 5 years.
"I don't mean to pry, but how exactly did that lead to marriage?"
"It's complicated."
"Do you mind telling me about it?"
"Not really, but I don't think you'd understand."
"There's only one way to find out."
"Well, to put it simply, it was the best way to get Peter out of the hospital and give him a chance to lead a more normal life."
"Couldn't you have been made his legal guardian?"
"The procedures were very complicated, and besides, Peter was no longer a minor."
"Wasn't that an enormous self-sacrifice on your part?"
"Not really. I was married once before, disastrously. It's not something I want for myself anymore. At least with Peter, there's a purpose to my life."
"Is it true that Stillman is being released?"
"Tomorrow. He'll be arriving at Grand Central in the evening."
"And you feel he might come after Peter? Is this just a hunch, or do you have some proof?"
"A little of both. 2 years ago, they were going to let Stillman out, but he wrote Peter a letter and I showed it to the authorities. They decided he wasn't ready to be released after all."
"What kind of letter was it?"
"An insane letter. He called Peter a devil boy and said there would be a day of reckoning."
"Do you still have the letter?"
"No. I gave it to the police 2 years ago."
"A copy?"
"I'm sorry. Do you think it's important?"
"It might be."
"I can try to get one for you if you like."
"I take it there were no more letters after that one?"
"No more letters. And now they feel Stillman is ready to be discharged. That's the official view in any case, and there's nothing I can do to stop them. What I think, though, is that Stillman simply learned his lesson. He realized that letters and threats would keep him locked up."
"And so you're still worried?"
"That's right."
"But you have no precise idea of what Stillman's plans might be?"
"Exactly."
"What is it you want me to do?"
"I want you to watch him carefully. I want you to find out what he's up to. I want you to keep him away from Peter.
In other words, a kind of glorified tail job.
I suppose so.
I think you should understand that I can't prevent Stillman from coming to this building. What I can do is warn you about it. And I can make it my business to come here with him.
I understand. As long as there's some protection.
Good. How often do you want me to check in with you?
I'd like you to give me a report every day. Say a telephone call in the evening around 10 or 11 o'clock.
No problem.
Is there anything else?
Just a few more questions. I'm curious, for example, to know how you found out that Stillman will be coming into Grand Central tomorrow evening.
I've made it my business to know, Mr. Oster. There's too much at stake here for me to leave it to chance. And if Stillman isn't followed from the moment he arrives, he could easily disappear without a trace. I don't want that to happen.
Which train will he be on?
The 641, arriving from Poughkeepsie.
I assume you have a photograph of Stillman?
Yes, of course.
There's also the question of Peter. I'd like to know why you told him about all this in the first place. Wouldn't it have been better to have kept it quiet?
I wanted to, but Peter happened to be listening in on the other phone when I got the news of his father's release. There was nothing I could do about it. Peter can be very stubborn, and I've learned it's best not to lie to him.
One last question. Who was it who referred you to me?
Mrs. Saavedra's husband, Michael. He used to be a policeman and he did some research. He found out that you were the best man in the city for this kind of thing.
I'm flattered.
From what I've seen of you so far, Mr. Oster, I'm sure we've found the right man.
Quinn took this as his cue to rise. It came as a relief to stretch his legs at last. Things had gone well, far better than he had expected, but his head hurt now, and his body ached with an exhaustion he had not felt in years. If he carried on any longer, he was sure to give himself away. "My fee is $100 a day plus expenses," he said. "If you could give me something in advance, it would be proof that I'm working for you, which would ensure us a privileged investigator-client relationship. That means everything that passes between us would be in strictest confidence."
Virginia Stillman smiled, as if at some secret joke of her own. Or perhaps she was merely responding to the possible double meaning of his last sentence. Like so many of the things that happened to him over the days and weeks that followed, Quinn could not be sure of any of it. "How much would you like?" she asked.
"It doesn't matter. I'll leave that up to you."
"500?"
"That would be more than enough."
"Good. I'll go get my checkbook."
Virginia Stillman stood up and smiled at Quinn again.
"I'll get you a picture of Peter's father, too. I think I know just where it is."
This is the end of disc number one. Please insert disc number two.